Today we're talking about college admission and scholarships. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Lee Benz, and I'm very glad that you're here. So let me explain how to pull everything all together so that you can get the college admission offers that you want and the scholarships that you need in order to make college affordable. I want to start off by just sharing a few stories about how even normal families can get big scholarships. You see, you have no reason to fear. I know that this is a time of stress for you, but I also know that you're committed to homeschooling, and that's why you're here. You know, I tell people that this is your vocation, your job, right? And that's why I encourage people to do continuing education. Well, so here's the thing with college admission and scholarships. What you want to do is to think about balance, right? You don't drop the ball, don't ignore it, don't pretend like it's never going to happen. But you do want to be engaged and relaxed and involved. And at the same time, remember that you are the school and you have school responsibilities. And so it's your job, right, to pay attention and to take these continuing education classes. Now, parents are the best guidance counselor. I know that you have this love for your child that will ensure your success. Michelle and her son were very successful. She got admission to all four colleges. She got a variety of scholarship offers at all colleges. And it was interesting in her letter, she said, you know, his SAT score was really not a top score, and he didn't do well on some of the AP tests after taking AP classes. But she did provide comprehensive homeschool records and transcripts. And Michelle wrote that one lady in the scholarship office said it was the best scholarship entry she had ever seen. So, you know, nobody is perfect. Certainly their family isn't perfect any more than my family is. But even normal families can get big scholarships. Now, I know sad stories can happen as well. Another mom was very sad. Her son was offered 3 full tuition scholarships. And yes, she was very sad about that. The reason is because he was not offered a scholarship at all to his first choice university. And so she and I talked at length about what happened, what had gone wrong, what was the missing piece. And in our long discussions, we found out that she had not visited their first choice college, not even one time. So what I'd like you to do is to pay close attention today when I'm talking about college admission and scholarships. Don't drop the ball, right? But invest in your continuing education so that you can be successful as well. So today we're going to talk about college admission and scholarships and how your normal family can get those as well. So here's what you're going to learn so you don't drop the ball. We're going to be talking about preparing for college, finding a college, how do you do that, applying for college, what the process is like, getting scholarships, a variety of different kinds, how do you face the reality of having a graduate, and finding the resources that you need. Now, we're going to be discussing each one of these in detail, and we'll have plenty of time for questions at the end. So let's start first by how exactly do you prepare for college? Well, you prepare for college by being the best guidance counselor that you can be. Now, I will say that you have all of the tools that you need at home. If you feel that beating heart of yours, that's the part that's going to make you successful because you know and love your children. And what that means is you know what your family requirements are, whether you want them to graduate early or graduate late or go to a Christian school or go to a public university or go to a large university. And also, you know your family situation. So you're not so much caring that they get into the most prestigious school. You're caring that you can afford to send them to college, not the admission, but the actual going, right? And so all of those are reasons why you're going to be the best guidance counselor as you homeschool through high school. So let's talk about the first step of being a good guidance counselor, and that means that you meet the college prep requirements. So here's the problem with college prep requirements. Every college has their own policies on what they want to see. So they vary by college. But there are some usual requirements. So I encourage you to use the planning guide frequently. The planning guide is one of the handouts today, and it's on your handout for college admission scholarships as well. As you're looking at the planning guide, I want you to think about exceeding requirements. The more that you can exceed normal requirements, the more you're able to get big scholarships. It's not as scary as you'd think, because kids that are homeschooling will sometimes love something and you'll collect more credits that way and exceed more credits that way. Or they'll take something during summer, or they'll take a high school class while they're in middle school. So it's actually not as difficult as you would think to exceed requirements. And I'm going to teach you how to do that today. So here is what is considered the minimum college prep requirements. Okay. Colleges, I have never seen an exception. Colleges want to see 4 years of English. For English, it can include any communication skills, reading, writing, listening, speaking. But they have specific words for it. They like to call it literature and composition. And so literature just means reading, and composition just means writing. So your job is to provide 4 years of reading and writing. For math, colleges want to see 4 years. They want to see your child get through 1 year, textbook level of math every year. They definitely want to see math during senior year. So even if you've done a lot of math in middle school, keep going and do that 4 years in high school of math. For social studies, colleges want to see 3 to 4 credits, and they're a little bit more specific. Instead of just, anything involving literature and composition or anything math at their level, they're a little more specific when it comes to social studies. When they specify, colleges will tell you they want to see American history, world history, economics, and government. Usually American history and world history are 1 credit each, and usually economics and government are a half a credit each, but it can be more, and that's one of the ways that you can exceed requirements, by going 1 year of economics or government. In addition, colleges want to see at least 3 years of science, which can come as a surprise to homeschoolers who assume they have to teach it all 4 years. Another way to exceed requirements if you do 4 years. And within sciences, colleges will say they want to have at least one of those be a lab science. There is no definition of what a lab science is, by the way. So what I tell people is that if you have purchased the lab equipment and you've done most of the labs, then you can say it is a science with a lab. And then for foreign language, colleges would like to see 2 to 4 years of a single foreign language. They don't want you to dabble, right? 1 year of French and 1 year of Spanish, 1 year of German. They want you to become reasonably understanding of the language, right? So 2, 3, or 4 years of German, okay? Now, so that doesn't mean you have to stick to just one language. Some people will start foreign language in middle school or branch out to a second language after they've completed the first. For PE, not as many colleges have a PE requirement, but some look at it as proof of socialization. So for PE, colleges like to see 2 years, 2 credits. It's okay to have a half a credit for all 4 years of school, and that adds up to 2 years. And PE, by the way, can include physical education, not just exercise. So it can include health and first aid, CPR, that sort of thing. For the fine arts, colleges want to see 1 year of fine art, which I realize is quite offensive to people that really love their fine arts, but that's what's usually required. The fine arts are music, art, theater, or dance. And you can teach 1 year of one thing, or you can teach 1 year of a combination of those things, or you can teach fine art every year, or multiple fine arts every year. Okay? That's how you would exceed requirements, right? By having music every year. And then you want to have enough electives so that the student has 24 or more credits for their electives. I'm not for electives, but overall credits, right? Your goal is 24 or more overall credits. So let me talk about the three different kinds of electives, right? There's three sources for your homeschool electives. The first is things that are required by your state homeschool law. So maybe your state requires the state history, right? And then that would be a requirement. In our state, I live in Washington, our state requires occupational education. So that's required by my state law. The second source of electives is things that are required by the parents, right? And so if you're requiring your child to do, auto mechanics or home economics or Bible classes, maybe critical thinking or logic classes, those are required by parents and those are a source of electives as well. And the third source of electives is the things that the student does for fun. So if they love painting, that's all they want to do all day, then that is one of your electives. Now, when you're encouraging them with their electives, that's actually a good thing because what you're doing is you're encouraging delight-directed learning. Now, colleges call that passion or specialization, right? Often homeschoolers will call it delight-directed learning. And it's a good thing for you to have, whether that is something like painting or music, or I had a child that was passionate about economics, which is totally geeky, I will agree. So when you think about how do you identify delight-directed learning, usually you can identify it easily through annoyance, right? If you are annoyed with something that your child does frequently, then often that annoyance can indicate your specialization or passion or delight-directed learning. So if your child is never emptying the dishwasher and is always playing the piano or studying economics or playing on their chessboard, then that can indicate that they have a specialization, and it can be a class on the high school transcript. Sometimes when they love something so deeply and they just dive into something, it can even indicate college credits. You can include that information on their activity list and show the different passionate interests that they've had over time. And what that does is it shows the uniqueness of your child. Now, actually, delight-directed learning is one of the best ways to get your child involved in thinking about careers or aptitudes, because every time they try something new in their delight-directed learning, it's sort of learning a career by trial and error. So whether they're involved in entrepreneurship or even if they're mowing yards for someone, this specialization, this delight-directed learning, can give them feedback on what kind of careers they would like to have as an adult. Now, during high school, of course, there's more than just academics, right? We're also trying to raise adults and not just, you know, hold our children forever, right? Students are more than just academics. So the work skills matter. And, you know, one of the things I tell people is that the best way to teach a strong work ethic is to actually make school challenging for them. You don't want it to be easy all the time. It shouldn't be overwhelming, right? You don't want to go into the other extreme of being too difficult. But for example, math, people ask me all the time, why do we have to have math every year? We're not going to use math in our daily life. Well, math is hard. And so learning math teaches a strong work ethic. It teaches children how to work hard. And those work skills matter. But life skills matter too, right? You need to make sure your child understands cooking and cleaning and banking and, you know, all the independent living skills that you have to have in order to be a grown adult. And, you know, that doesn't happen the first day of high school. It can take 4 years before they really have started to understand those independent living skills. And character development. Any buddy who hires kids will tell you that character is the number one thing that they're looking for when they have a new hire. So your job is to impart that godly character, the wholesome values, the character development that they need to be successful in both college and in life. And then finally, as you're thinking about being the guidance counselor, you want to be thinking about the PSAT. I know we were chatting about that just a little bit earlier before we got the class started, but you want to take the PSAT for fun and profit. And here's why. The PSAT is offered one time a year for 11th graders, but you can take the test, the PSAT, for just for fun in October of 10th grade. And what that does is it gives you, as the parent, practice registering them for the test, because it's usually our first, you know, major foray into the public school. And how do you register your child for the test? It takes a little bit of know-how. So I encourage people to have their child take the PSAT in 10th grade so you can learn how to register and learn, you know, things like, well, do they register 2 weeks in advance or 6 months in advance? And it varies by school. And, you know, do they give you grief? How easy is it? Do you have your ID? That sort of thing. And then in 11th grade, I encourage you to take the PSAT for profit in October of 11th grade. And that's when the National Merit Scholarship comes into play. And I'm going to be going over the National Merit Scholarship later on, but I just wanted to make sure that we covered this part first. You do need to register very early at your local high school. There are some high schools that register you for the October PSAT, even in May the previous year. So you do need to figure out how to register early, okay? So that's the PSAT. All right, now the next thing we're going to be talking about is finding a college, all right? Now, actually, that PSAT that you just took is a great way to get that party started, because they will ask you if they can release information to colleges, and you can say yes to that on the PSAT, and that will put your child sort of on the radar, right, for that homeschoolers are off the grid sometimes. The colleges don't know you're there. But by taking the PSAT and allowing them to send your information to colleges, then they'll know that you exist. And then if they really need a kid that, you know, has all their requirements from your state, then they will start marketing to you, and that can help you to find a college that way. But there are many ways to start finding a college, so let me talk you through that process. The first step is, after the PSAT, the first step is to attend a college fair. Now, you can find a college fair usually in most medium-sized big cities. There's a variety of different college fairs. There's a fine art college fair. There's major, huge college fairs. There's much smaller Christian college fairs. There's a lot of them, right? And it is definitely worth a trip to your next largest big city in order to go to a college fair. So what do? It's sort of like going to a homeschool convention, right? But this time it's for you to interact with colleges rather than with curriculum providers. So you bring your children. When you're at the college fair, you have your children prepared questions in advance that they are going to ask. It can be so easy questions, anything they want. Do you have a baseball team? I mean, it can be anything that the kid wants. And then you have the child ask questions first. Once the college representative and your child have run out of questions and the conversation comes to a lull, then the parents can ask their questions. You might ask about their homeschool policy, asking it in a nice open-ended question rather than you know, getting angry before you know their policy. Is there anything special you would like from a homeschool family? Or we are a homeschool family. Is there anything I can do to help you in making decisions about a homeschool student? Right? When you're at the college fair, they do have classes like conventions do, and you can grab some freebies, some pens, and, you know, magnets and that sort of fun stuff. And after you've gone to the college fair, you'll start to realize the kinds of colleges that your child is interested in. And it may be, kind of surprising. Maybe you didn't know she wanted to go to a big school instead of a small school, right? So then after the college fair, you can decide which colleges you want to research more carefully. Now, to do that, you want to carefully compare the college statistics. There are large phone books filled with information on college statistics. I do encourage you to get a book of statistics rather than search online because the internet never ends. And when you get a college statistic book, like Peterson's Guide to Four-Year Colleges or something like that, those big books, they will only have one page of information or less per child, or I'm sorry, per college. So you're able to read every single detail on that one college without, going down too many rabbit holes, and then the next thing you don't have any information on the other colleges you were supposed to look at. While you're reading those statistics, read every single word on that one page for the colleges that you're interested in. And you'll notice that they'll tell you like SAT scores that the average student has there. So you just want to be comparing your child's statistics to the college statistics. Now, as you do your job then and you're looking at all the statistics, figuring out whether your child would be a good fit there or not, do they have the major your child is interested in, where are they located, that sort of thing. And then you decide on a handful of colleges where you want to visit. Now, here are the keys to the college visit. I think the most important thing is that you visit and take notes. Now, a college visit is the only way to know if the college is a good fit. Because in all of the statistics books and even the online reviews, you're not going to know if the college has co-ed showers or just co-ed dorms unless you actually visit the college. So you definitely want to go. So here's the keys, right? Visit colleges junior year, that's 11th grade, or earlier. It's perfectly fine to go earlier. 10th grade is great. 9th grade is great. Before 9th grade, they don't want you to take as many of the classes, but they still don't mind, right? Visit colleges. You want to plan ahead to schedule your visit, right? So you call or you email them to schedule an official visit. That means they're waiting for you. They're eager for you. And then you'll be meeting the admission office representatives. It's sort of like the college fair again. You let the child talk first, and then when they run out of information, then you can ask school stuff like, would you like to see course descriptions? Would it help you to see course descriptions? Do you have any requirements for homeschoolers? And you can ask parent stuff too, like, what kind of scholarships do you have? On average, what does, an average student get for scholarships, that sort of thing. While you're at the college, then the student can attend a class that the student might enjoy. Not something you might enjoy, but the student. It is helpful if you take a freshman level class so that they're not totally blown out of the water by what they're hearing. It's not too complicated because it's engineering or something. During the visit, you'll take a guided campus tour. Usually that is done by another student, and the student will give you some insight on what the college is like and what it's really like there. Now, while you're visiting, make sure that the student takes notes. It's helpful to jot down the names of people that you talk to, any important details. You don't have to take notes when you're talking to people. That would not be polite, but afterwards. Now, I will say do not take notes on your phone because then it looks like you're just, Snapchatting with somebody. So take notes on paper and pencil, not on your phone. And then after your visit, the student should send a thank you note and let them know that they appreciated the time of the people that they interacted with. Now, colleges can look completely the same on paper, but be completely different when you visit them. So I wanted to tell you our tale of three colleges that we experienced. We did careful research. We met them at a college fair, and three specific colleges were very, very similar on paper. They were all religiously based colleges, about the same size, mostly generally in my area of the state, and had a lot of similarities. They offered the same majors, that sort of thing. So same SAT scores. I mean, they were like the same on paper. And when we went to visit College A, we were really surprised at the school was not at all what we had expected a faith-based college to be. They had taken the chapel, and it was no longer used as a chapel. It was used as a theater. And the name of the play that was showing that week had vulgarity in the name of the play. And so the sign was covering the word chapel with these, you know, gigantic 3-foot-tall letters of vulgarity that my children are looking at. And, you know, we were visiting colleges at 10th grade, 11th grade, and it was appalling. They also had Healthy Bodies Week. They were celebrating Healthy Bodies Week. And I thought that was going to be such a great thing because I am an RN and, you know, nurses like healthy bodies, right? Well, you know, not so much. They had the emphasis was on free love. There was a class called Sex and Scones, which I thought I did not want my boys to equate those two things with equal interest. And it was just really appalling. We were appalled. Nobody looked happy. I actually ate spoiled ham at that college. No kidding. We went to visit College B, also a faith-based college. It was more inside the city, and because of that, the security was incredibly tight. We never even got to see the admission official's office. He came out to us in the public area, so we're having our discussion in this very public lobby. And that was all the information we could get through to him. Also, they had quite an impenetrable bureaucracy. We had signed up in advance online, and they had lost our request for certain classes. My kids wanted to take certain classes at that college to see what classes were like, and they had lost it. And they said, oh, no, you can't do that. They just couldn't turn on a dime. And my younger son was going to be graduating early, and they didn't want children of his age attending classes. And it was just quite a bureaucracy, so we were a little surprised by that. When we visited College C, also exactly similar on paper, faith-based, downtown, and they were celebrating Happy Bodies Week as well, Healthy Bodies Week. And so I was nervous because we were visiting all these colleges in the same week. And I thought, what am I doing to my children, you know? And but their Healthy Bodies Week was remarkably about healthy bodies, right? And nutrition and exercise and how to stay fit in college and all this stuff. And our tour guide was walking us around, very happy, student that was giving us the tour. The whole campus was filled with smiling, happy students, and that's when we realized that it was a perfect fit for our kids. So we were really surprised at how much colleges could differ after looking at them on paper. Now, a college visit is the only way to know what a college is really like. People have come back to me shocked and said, I didn't know they would be selling pot on campus. I did not know they would be reading that book in English class. So visiting can make a huge difference in your decisions. But also, each visit that you make to the college can make a difference in scholarships. As the college knows that you've checked them out, they know that you know you're a good fit. And so you're more likely to attend. And that's why it helps you get scholarships. Now, when you're visiting colleges, I need to mention those people that are highly driven and very eager to get into the top-ranked colleges. So let's talk a little bit about the Ivy League. I think the most important thing that I can convey in just, 2 minutes is that the Ivy League and highly selective schools reject most qualified students. They can reject 95% of highly qualified students, some of them. It's not uncommon for them to reject 80% of students that are qualified to go. So you can't ask yourself, why was my student rejected? Most qualified students are rejected. So when you want to go to the Ivy League, then here's what you need to do. You want to start your research early in high school. Look it up, find out what their requirements are, not only their requirements, but their expectations as well. Check their admission requirements, but also check their homeschool requirements. Those can be different at times. Sometimes they're similar, but sometimes different. What's interesting is their expectations are not always the same as their requirements. They may say they require 5 SAT-2 subject tests, but what they actually expect to see is 5 AP subject tests, right? So you're trying to weigh that. When you're looking at the Ivy League, remembering that everybody is qualified, most everybody is qualified, that applies. You want to make sure that you exceed their expectations in some way. If your child is, good at history, let them take more history classes, that sort of thing. And then provide great homeschool records. They're looking very carefully at who is academically prepared for the rigor of college work. And so you want to be able to prove that they're academically prepared with those records. And then always have a backup plan. Okay, have some colleges there that you are applying to so that you can be successful in the long term. One of my current members, she reached out to me after her child had been rejected by every Ivy League school. And she really thought that because he was qualified, that one of them surely would let her child in and get admitted. And he was rejected by all of them. And they were just devastated. There is one thing that is worse than being rejected by all 8 Ivy League schools. And that is not having a place to go for college after you've been rejected by all 8 Ivy League schools. So have a college that you're going to apply to that will give you admission and scholarship. So do apply to a variety of colleges and not just Ivy League schools. Now, all students, not just the Ivy League types, right? All students, all children need to apply to 4 to 8 colleges. Do not just apply to your first choice university. I see that problem a lot. Don't apply to your first 1 and 2. Apply to 4 to 8 colleges. We applied to 4, and that's a minimum, right? When you're looking at colleges, I want you to apply for both public and private universities. This might be important. You want to write this down, but often public and private universities are the same cost because private universities give you bigger scholarships and public universities don't. And so if you have, slightly above average SAT scores, ACT scores, then often the cost will be the same. You should apply to more than 4 to 8 colleges if you're including any Ivy League schools, right? So what I usually say is you apply to at least 4 colleges plus the Ivy League schools that you're applying to. And then I need you to apply for reach, fit, and safety schools. So let me explain that for a second. What you want to do is you want to compare your child's test scores, ACT or SAT scores, to the college's average test score. And that will help you to decide whether each college is a reach or a fit or a safety school. A reach school means that the child may qualify. Your test scores are lower than average compared to most, but you meet the requirements. All Ivy League schools are always a reach school, no matter how qualified you are. A fit school means that your child is a perfect match academically. Your test scores are average compared to others. You meet the requirements. A safety school means that your child is almost certain to gain admission. Your test scores are higher than everyone's, and you exceed requirements, right? Now, if your child doesn't get into their REACH school or a FIT school or their number one school, and all they have is that safety school, you're going to be so glad that your child has a college to go to that they can afford to go to, right? But also, your child can transfer to another university the following year, right? Now remember, Ivy League schools are always REACH for every student, and they do reject overqualified students 90% of the time. Now, as you're looking at colleges, it's really important to start realizing, wow, junior year is really very important, right? Because your goal for junior year is to find a college by the end of the year. So there's certain things that have to take place during junior year in order to be successful. So let me show you how it all pulls together. We've talked about many of these things, right? The first is to take the PSAT in October, right? That's going to help you figure out if you get the National Merit Scholarship. Next, you want to choose between the SAT test or the ACT test and have your child study for the test that's best for them. And then you want to attend a college fair and go on college visits, compare those statistics. All the while they're studying for the SAT or the ACT. Only the test that's best for them. Don't study for both at the same time. And then what I like for people to do is to take the SAT or ACT for real in the spring two times. I'd love for you to take it in, say, March. And then have your children take it again in, say, May or June, right? That way you have two test scores to look at, and if scholarships are tied to test scores, then you have increased your chances of scholarship by taking it two times. Before junior year ends, make sure you have completed all your high school records. It's way too easy to wait and say, I'll do that during the summer, and then summer goes and you haven't done it, right? So complete all of your high school records before junior year ends. And then by the last day of junior year, you want to make sure that you have decided on 4 to 8 colleges where your child is going to apply. Now let's talk about applying. That's the next step, isn't it? Right? This is the senior year home stretch, that application process. By the way, it is a long process. It is not a short moment. and applications begin September and sometimes even earlier, and the process can take months. And so you want to have all the pieces ready to go before senior year even starts, right? The college is chosen, the tests have all been taken, the admission requirements have been met. One big tip about applying to college, if you do have a student that's doing dual enrollment, they're in the community college or online dual enrollment college classes, it can really help you if you work on your applications the summer before senior year, because dual enrollment is such an intense time and the grades are so important. It's really hard to put school on hold when you're doing dual enrollment. So starting early makes sense. All right, so let me start by walking you through senior year and what it's like. During senior year, you want to complete all the applications early, right? Now, the application has a lot of moving parts. The student needs to write many self-reflective, technically perfect essays. And that can be overwhelming. I mean, just saying self-reflective and technically perfect essay, is that not, doesn't that sound hard? And it can be hard. But also the application is a form and with lots and lots of questions. Some fill in the blank, some multiple choice, some are short essay questions, you know, and it takes a lot of time to fill them out. It's like, well, who knew you were going to have to write 200 words on that? That's just crazy, you know. And so there's lots of forms. But also they have very firm deadlines. If you miss it, that's it. They call it dead, you know, you're dead. So don't miss the deadline. And then you have to have your records complete. They need to be comprehensive, completed, and totally ready to go, every single piece of them. During senior year, you also can fill any academic gaps with tests or classes. Now, this is when I'm going to get really real with you, all right? My child had an academic gap. I discovered it when he was, in 11th grade. And so what happened was his brother, who loves economics, I accidentally forgot to teach his sibling economics because Alex was learning it for fun. I totally forgot to teach Kevin economics. So I, too, had to fill in an economic gap. So you fill in anything that's missing. You take any tests that are needed. You take any classes that are needed. Another big piece of senior year is that you complete the FAFSA on October 1. I have lots of information on my website on the FAFSA, but basically it's a way to get need-based scholarships. And then you want to decide by the end of the year, you fill out all these applications early, and then these scholarships come in. Well, by the end of senior year, you need to decide which college the student is going to actually attend, based on the whole financial picture. Now, we talked about how your homeschool records have to be complete, and it's because your homeschool records are the proof on paper that your child is well-educated, right? Colleges want information. They need to have a transcript with actual grades on it. Many scholarships are based on GPA, and grades matter. Even though you may feel like they are subjective, all grades in all high schools are subjective. You need to have a transcript with grades. You need to have course descriptions with a reading list and activities and awards list, or maybe a resume. Work samples, particularly of writing. And then ask the colleges what they want and give them whatever they want. That's my number one tip for scholarships. If it doesn't, offend your morality in some way, if they ask you to give you a piece of paper, then you go ahead and give them that piece of paper. So let's talk for a moment about how to strengthen your application with outside documentation. Most kids will use the SAT or ACT test. That's usually all the outside documentation that you need. You have that test, you're good to go, right? But there are other test options as well. You could have a SAT subject test. Those are high school level, pretty simple. You know, it's not really hard to get those. You could have an AP test for outside validation. AP test is an essay test and it's college level, so it's a lot harder. And you can also do some research on the CLEP test, CLEP. It's college level, but it's multiple choice and on the computer, so it's a little more flexible. Now, there's also non-test options that you can do to increase the strength of your application. And non-test options would include some dual enrollment at the community college, having great letters of recommendation, a work resume because they have actual jobs outside of the home. Those are some non-test options. During the application process, the student is going to need to have letters of recommendation sent directly from a recommender to the college you're applying to. That's one of the reasons why it doesn't really help you to collect letters of recommendation during your whole high school career, because you have to get letters that are current that are sent directly to the college. It does not look good if you've seen the letter of recommendation before it goes to the college, because then it looks like, you know, you helped them along with the letter of recommendation. They want it to be an independent letter of recommendation. So letters of recommendation are almost always required for college and job application. So, you know, this is a good thing to learn about. Here's the big keys for recommendation letters. First, you have to understand that recommendations take a lot of time to write. People, you know, don't just sit there and wait for you to ask them. They have busy lives, and so sometimes it can take weeks, and then they have to figure out how to get the application to the college. The best recommender is someone who knows your child well and who writes well. The challenge with that is that we don't always know who writes well. That's one of the reasons why it's best to have a recommender that's, you know, owns a business or is a college professor or a good friend that has a teaching degree or writes for his job or her job or something like that. Now, good recommendations have a very specific format. I do have information on letters of recommendation on my website, but there's a formal template for a letter of recommendation, and it should include a very clear conclusion that tells them exactly that your child is recommended. I strongly recommend this child, something like that. Now, in addition to letters of recommendation, sometimes they want, colleges will ask for additional things like a school profile or, you know, cover letter might be needed, but that's just one of the pieces of paper we might need to work on. Now, while you are thinking about your record keeping that you need to do, the job of the student is to actually work on the college application essays. So let me try to explain this in a way that a teenager might understand, okay? When you're writing a college application essay, it's like painting a selfie, right? It's a portrait that you're writing in words about yourself, right? So when you think about posting selfies on social media, each picture is very, very different of who you are. That's kind of what the application essays are like. Now, these essays, they take a lot of time. Weeks, you have to brainstorm and think it through and first draft, second draft, third draft, have somebody else edit it, you know? So you want to be sure to allow yourself enough time. Now, the college application essays, again, are self-reflective and technically perfect. The self-reflective part means that it is the unique self-portrait that the teenager writes about themselves. So it does say, I, me, my, okay, written in the first person. And because each one should be a different selfie of who you are, a different portrait that you're painting of yourself with words, never repeat anything between essays. So for those of you who know me, I had one child that loves history and economics, right? So he was only allowed to use the words history, economics, or Thomas Jefferson in only one of his essays. In all of the other essays he was required, couldn't use those words. They had to be about a completely different part of his personality. So you never repeat anything. But it is possible to use essays from many colleges. So many of their essay writing prompts will be quite similar, you know, reflect on a book you read or something. Well, many colleges ask that question, so you can usually reuse your essays over and over. When you do that, perfect the essay first, and then save a different version of this perfected essay for each college. And then you go into the college's specific one, and you personalize it as much as you can. You can mention who you spoke to at the college, what classes that you took, anything that would fit in there to personalize that essay for the college. And then you save each one, right? So you start out with one perfect essay, and then you wrote it four different ways for the four different colleges that you're applying to. But then you have to go back to the actual essay prompt and make sure that you've answered the question. Okay, so the big keys here that maybe you need to write down is make sure you answered the question. Be sure you never repeat anything, okay? And the one tip I can give you is it can really help you to practice writing your application essays during junior year We've mentioned how you've been to a college fair and visited colleges there. Well, you can pick up their essay prompts. They'll give you a paper application to start filling out. And usually you can look at their college application essay prompts there. And you can use that for your English credit during junior year, and that can kind of help you to get started with that goal. All right, let's talk about your role in the college application. There is quite a division of responsibility. Again, the student is in charge of completing the application forms and the essays, and the parent is in charge of working on the school and parent stuff. So you do the record keeping and worry about the finances. I will say that as you are dividing up your roles and the student is totally in charge of the essay, I can say it really, really helps if for writing the college admission essay if the parent and student will brainstorm together. One of the things I was a little surprised about was that when I read an application essay prompt, I thought it meant one thing, and my teenagers didn't understand what they were looking for. One of the essays they had to write was on diversity, and my children said, but I can't write on diversity because I'm a white guy, you know? And so we talked about the different ways that they interacted with diversity in their daily life, and then we talked about, well, then how could you write an essay about the things that you normally do and you just hadn't thought about it before? And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to have the parent and teen brainstorm together. Now, the student needs to complete the essay, not the parent, so that it sounds like a student. They do know when a parent has written it and it is bad and they will reject you out of hand. But the parent or other adult can provide feedback, and the student can use that feedback to make that essay technically perfect. So the parent can, you know, suggest another word to use. It's up to the student to use it to make sure that it sounds like them. But it is okay for the student to incorporate your edits. All right, let's talk about scholarships really briefly so that you can understand how do you go about getting scholarships. Scholarship chances do increase with preparation. And if you start working early, then the process during junior year or before, you can do really well. So for example, when you complete your high school records, you get more scholarships. A high GPA can provide automatic scholarships, so make sure you give grades. Course descriptions can prove academic rigor and college readiness. And college visits can demonstrate interest. So there's lots of different ways to improve your chances of getting scholarships. Now, scholarship chances do increase with test preparation, and it can have a really huge payoff because at many colleges, test scores are directly tied to scholarships. If you get this score, you get this scholarship. If you get one more point on your score, you get $10,000 more, right? So good scores can earn scholarships. So that's one of the reasons why you want to choose the SAT or ACT test carefully and use the best test for your student. And then you want to have them practice regularly each week. They don't have to be genius kids. They only have to be as smart as they can personally be on their test in order to get good scholarships. The next thing is that understanding each college visit is essentially like a college interview. And there are scholarship competitions where they will invite the student to the college for a day-long interview, basically, to decide who's most worthy of scholarships. So if you are going to face a college interview or visit a college, be prepared with some questions that you'd like to ask. Have your child dress neatly and cleanly. That was quite challenging for one of my children, not challenging at all for the other. Be confident and polite. Look people in the eye. Shake hands firmly, but don't break their hand. Engage in conversation, but also be very relaxed and have fun. I was amazed at how the relax and had fun had more to do with my children getting scholarships than many of the other things. And after the competition or interview, make sure you write a note of thanks by email or paper, snail mail, just to say thank you. So let's talk about how to find private scholarships. It's impossible to do a Google search for scholarships because there's way too many hits for you to follow up on. So instead, it helps to use a scholarship application website where you can put in information about your student first and then get scholarship opportunities that are tailored to your child. So you want to filter out any irrelevant suggestions. I encourage people to use the one strike and you're out mantra because you don't worry about, you know, why wouldn't they let us use that at a different college or why can't my child apply if they didn't go to that high school? Then just forget it. One strike and they're out. And then you format the scholarships by due date so that you won't miss any of the deadlines. The follow through has to be done by the student. That's quite challenging as they write applications. You can do this during junior year, though, and senior year, and it's a great way to use your English skills and to earn your English credit. And then you file the credits and awards as they go through. So if you are writing for scholarship essays and you're doing that for maybe an hour a day for a whole school year, that's going to be one high school English credit. The essays that you write for scholarships can be reused for other scholarships. Nobody shares them with one another as long as they're written by your student. And you can reuse those essays for college applications as well. So if you find that they've written a very good scholarship essay during their junior year and it won a great prize, you can reuse that essay again for the college application. Now let's talk about how to find need-based scholarships. This is tied very closely to the FAFSA. You'll get more information on the FAFSA when you need it, but if you just look up the letters FAFSA, you'll find lots on my website. You want to apply on October 1st of senior year, and when you hear back, they'll offer you money in a variety of ways, grants, scholarships that you do not have to pay back, loans that you do have to pay back, and work study, which kind of feels like working for minimum wage. Now, the thing with the need-based scholarships, like all scholarships, you want to be first in line for the money. So definitely apply October 1st. The farther away from the first day, the less money they have remaining in grants and scholarships. The grants and scholarships go first. And the loans are given out to people that are not first in line. There is a form called the CSS Profile. It's available on the collegeboard.org. And that is useful for people that have extenuating circumstances. Their FAFSA is tied to their taxes from the IRS. Well, your taxes on the IRS don't show the full picture of college, of the parents' finances. And so for some, the CSS profile is required by some colleges and also helpful in other situations. So one special scholarship is tied to the PSAT, and that's called the National Merit Scholarship. Let me talk you through that process really quickly. It kind of begins during sophomore year. That's one of the reasons why I want you to take the PSAT for just for fun sophomore year so that they can be calm and relaxed when they take it for real. And also that's your opportunity to see what their score might be, see if they might be in the running for the National Merit Scholarship. And if they are, you can begin your SAT preparation in 10th grade because they're so close to getting that big scholarship. During junior year, they need to register for and take the PSAT for real as an 11th grader. That's when it is tied to the National Merit Scholarship. In December, you'll get their PSAT scores back, and at that point, you'll get notified on the likelihood of beginning the National Merit Scholarship competition. In junior year in the spring, if you are going to compete for the National Merit Scholarship, you must take the SAT test. Even if your child is better at the ACT, if you're going to be the National Merit Scholar, you have to take the SAT test. During September of senior year, your child will be notified whether they are commended or semi-finalists. Now, the semifinalists, they have to fill out a long application. And what you need to know is that you are considered the school. And so you have to fill out the school's information to part of the application. And that requires course descriptions. So they need to be thorough and done. You can't send it in as a whole package of course descriptions, but you will be cutting and pasting that into the applications that they ask for. In December of senior year, the SAT scores are sent to the National Merit Scholarship, and later on in the spring, the finalists are notified that they're semifinalists or finalists. So in March, the National Merit Scholarship is announced, but you don't actually get the money yet. In April, the corporations that give the money, that's when they award the scholarships. And in May, the final National Merit Scholars are notified. And by summer, the scholarship awards are announced to the media. So you can see it's a long process. I don't want you to worry too much about it. Even with the National Merit Scholar, real homeschoolers are successful in scholarships without being a National Merit Scholar. Renee's older daughter, for example, did not get the National Merit Scholarship. She was only a semifinalist, and yet she got a full ride scholarship based on her ACT scores. My own children weren't even in the competition. They were merely commended students. But they both got full tuition scholarships to their first choice university. So I don't want you to panic about the national merit. I want you to keep moving forward, but I did want you to know kind of what it was like. Now, as you are working hard on scholarships, you need to remember that the bottom line is what you can actually afford to pay for college, right? So when the awards start to come in, you want to count the college costs. Compare how much it would cost out of pocket. When you write the first big check, how much is it going to be? College costs vary widely. The cost of living has a huge impact on college costs. So you can't really compare scholarships. A more expensive school might offer you a huge scholarship, but still end up being the most expensive college. And look beyond the money too, and consider the livability at the college. How much does your child like it? What is the support system there? Do you have family or friends that are close by in case of emergency? So your goal is to look for fit plus affordability plus the long-term goals that they have in mind. So again, you can see why if you need scholarships, you need to do your research now and work hard during junior and senior year for best success. Now, scholarships do come in waves over many months. You don't find out your scholarship awards the day that you find out you got into college. You may not know the final cost of a college until spring of senior year. So don't panic when you see the first scholarship award. The first wave of scholarships is based on SAT or ACT score or GPA. And that's why the test prep and the transcript grades are so important. The second wave of scholarships is based on the FAFSA and your financial need. That's why you want to turn in those financial aid forms early, the first day if possible, so that you can get in line for that money. And the third wave of scholarship is based on merit or skill. Maybe there's interviews or special competitions, or you want to get a special degree, or you get a scholarship because you're an athlete or a musician or science major of some sort. Okay? Now, each situation is unique and every homeschooler is unique. And I do know that sometimes bad things can happen to good homeschoolers, but you can still find a way to succeed. Each college situation is very unique and every homeschool situation is very unique. And so when you face a unique situation yourself, you need to go into it with careful planning, right? Some colleges may put up a roadblock and request that you have a GED for admission. You want to be thinking ahead about that and be socially active and change policies. So most colleges now do not require the GED. The GED does have a negative connotation. It implies a high school dropout. So you want to be carefully planning to avoid that when all possible. A gap year is can be taken after high school, before going to college. And if you are considering a gap year, that too requires careful planning. Usually to maximize scholarships, you apply during senior year as normal, talking to the college about taking a gap year, and then they will hold your scholarship and your admission for you while you take your gap year, and then you can come back and return and to get those scholarships. Struggling learners, it's important for you to understand that struggling learners succeed in colleges. A full 30% of kids admitted to college need some remedial help. So if you have a struggling learner, you fit right in. There are colleges that specialize in struggling learners. So when you're doing your college fairs, you can look around at the information on the college fair to find out which ones specialize in struggling learners. You want to make sure that you're not overworking and doing too much during high school, or underworking and doing too little during high school. Some parents will face a crisis year, a health crisis, a family crisis of some sort, and you need to carefully plan through those sorts of situations. Dangerous or difficult situations can arise. Depression is... internet addictions. There's lots of information that can come up during high school that you never thought as a parent you would be faced with, and that requires careful planning. And you'll always have some friends that are saying that should Christians even go to college, or on the other hand, shouldn't all Christians try to go to Harvard? And so it can be frustrating as you're listening to all these different opinions. So you want to be thinking, too, about once you're done with homeschooling, what are you going to do with your career as a homeschool parent? Do you have more coming up, or are you going to be changing careers like I did after high school? Now, as you're going through the years of high school, I just want you to remember that you are trying to create diamonds, right? Children with character. And you remember when shopping for a diamond ring, when we got engaged, and they were always talking about cut, color, clarity, and carat weight. Well, it's the same sort of thing with homeschooling. We are trying to create children with character. The cut means that they're hardworking and honest. They're cut out to be honest people. That's all there is to it. Their color means they're colorful kids, right? Genuine, unique. Not the same as everyone else. Clarity means they can communicate clearly in writing and in speaking and in person. And the carat weight means that they have the rigorous, weighty college prep classes, the academic preparation that is required for college or career. Now, during the end of senior year, this is really important. I need you to provide your children with a diploma, because at some point your children are going to be asked, do you have a high school diploma? And you want your children to automatically, instantaneously say yes. You don't want them to hem and haw and say, I don't really know if I have a high school diploma. I was homeschooled. Or no, even worse, no, I don't have a high school diploma. I was homeschooled. That's bad. So you give them a high school diploma. Make sure that you provide a final transcript. It may not be required for you the day that they graduate, but what happens 10 years from now when their job requirement is that you have to show your high school transcript? That's why people that have 28-year-olds sometimes come to me and say, can you help me make a high school transcript? So make sure you have a transcript. It's easier now than it will be in 10 years. And then write your course descriptions. I did have one employer that required course descriptions. They were an employer in another country. They may be required from college or also to earn scholarships. And then I want you to save your records in both digital and paper form. You can email that to yourself as well so that you always have it. Email it to your child as a PDF. just so that you don't lose it in a fire or a hurricane or an earthquake. And then you want to celebrate their successful graduation. This is not at all like eighth grade graduation. This really matters. The points do matter with graduation, and it is a really good opportunity to celebrate their successful accomplishment and their entrance into adulthood. And then just mom to mom, remember that you are going to need to set boundaries after graduation and explain to them often very clearly what you will and will not provide for an adult living in your home. So having tough decisions about, well, okay, if you don't go to school, then you have to get a full-time job or whatever your boundaries are for your family. Let me just give you a few quick resources here. I wanted to make sure that you get the college, the planning guide. The planning guide is one of the handouts that you'll see today. But also look at the college-bound reading list. I believe I put the link on your handout. You might want to check me on that. But the college-bound reading list will help you to expose them to a variety of literature that they're going to need to increase their vocabulary for college. There is a coordinating reference book that I've written. It's called The Home Scholar Guide to College Admission and Scholarships. Basically, each long chapter in that book is about 5 minutes of my presentation today, so you can get much more information through that book. And then I do have a reference book on homeschool record keeping. It's called Setting the Record Straight, and that will help you with your transcripts and course descriptions. So, we are done with our class today, so I wanted to know if anybody has any questions. You can go ahead and put that into the question box, and I'm happy to answer that for you. So I'll give you a couple minutes to think about what questions you might have. I do want to say thank you all for coming today. I know that it's hard to take time off when you're a busy homeschool mom and doing the things that we do, and hopefully this the classes that I provide are easier than, you know, spending 3 whole days away at a homeschool convention or something, and more appropriate classes for the age groups of your children rather than having, you know, classes on, I don't know, homeschooling kindergarten, for example, like they often do at a convention. Okay, so Heather's question, we're going to a college fair later this month as a sophomore. What are some key things to keep in mind? Oh, good. I did take both of my children to a college fair in both 10th and 11th grade, and I do think that that is the best thing that you could do. So I guess one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that when you're meeting with colleges at a college fair, they notice you. They know who you are. They will ask you to fill in information with your name. Maybe they'll have a little pad of paper and, you know, write your name in here. Well, after you walk away, sometimes they'll make little notes on that piece of paper about you and who you are. Like you were homeschooled, or really smart kid, or kid wants to play baseball, or kid wants to swim, or something like that. And those are pieces of information that they use in the application process. Remember, we talked about how college visits are so important. That's because they notice every time you interact with the college. Well, that is true of going to a college fair too. It gives you a point, right? We've interacted with the college at the college fair, and then we go and we visit the college. And for many people overseas, it's a Skype interview, and that's the way that they reach out and touch the college. So each time you touch or interact with a college, they're taking notes on that. And the more times you interact with them, the more likely you are to get scholarships, because they think you're more interested in them. The other thing that I think that is really helpful for a college fair is, I guess I was a little surprised at how much I learned from the colleges that we didn't stop at. So my children would just walk right past some of the colleges with no interest whatsoever. Maybe they aren't at all interested in the big colleges that they've heard about. Maybe they're only interested in small colleges. Maybe they gravitate toward colleges that have stacks of great books on their table, or gravitate towards colleges that have, I don't know, the logo that they love, you know. So you want to make sure that you're looking not only at the colleges they do like, but at what they don't like, because that can help you in your college search. Miriam says, my question is about the goal of graduating at 16 and if it's a reasonable goal for emotionally mature children. Good question. There is a lot of maturity that takes place between 9th grade and 12th grade, or between the time they're 14 and 18 years old. Most 16-year-olds are just driving. They're still emotionally up and down. They don't have the skills that they need to pay rent on time, or handle scary situations, or deal maturely with immature content. The other thing is that when you go to a college that is a environment that is intended for adults, and as colleges struggle to keep the attention of young people, they are doing more and more what Hollywood is doing, including inappropriate situations and violence in their day-to-day teaching in order to keep people's attention. One young girl told me that the required reading for her class was 50 Shades. That came as a surprise for the mother. So you need to have a child that is mature enough to interact with the professor, do all of the interacting on their own, and make tough decisions about dropping classes, or being assertive enough to request or require a different reading if that's what's going to happen. So one of the things that I personally found, we did have a child that went to the university at age 16. We were very glad that he went to a small Christian college. He did find some friends that were able to help and guide him along, but it wasn't, he felt like they were parenting him a little bit, that he wasn't really looked upon as an equal in some ways. And because it was such a challenging drive, even at the age 16, his entire first year of college, we were dropping him off at college and driving back in to pick him up and bring him home. And he lived at home for the first year, and he felt like that was challenging then, because he didn't, because he wasn't there for all of the evening activities, he didn't feel like he was able to make friends as much as he wanted to. So there's just a lot of interesting things for you to consider in the process of applying, because my son was very mature. He had been speaking at international conferences on economics, and was great at many of the work. He had been working at a think tank, and one day a week he went to the office, same hours as my husband, went to the office at a think tank. So he was very used to being in the world, but that's different than having the readiness for college and the ability to live alone and pay your bills and that sort of thing. Okay, Heather says, I don't have his transcript ready. Will this hurt him while attending a college fair? No, it will not hurt him at all, because they're used to seeing just teenagers coming from busloads filled with public school kids, who none of whom have the transcript. What it can do is give you some positive feedback, and you can say, this is his transcript in process. Can you give me some feedback? Is this the kind of homeschool transcript that you are used to? Is there anything that you can suggest? That was awkward for me, because sometimes they would take it from my hand, but then I'd say, that's my only copy. Can I not leave that with you? And they would say, okay. That sort of information can show you to be one of those homeschool moms who plans ahead and keeps records and educates their children and Even if your class titles aren't just perfect, they're reading it over and they're thinking, oh, okay, we got the math, we got the science, we got the English. Yeah, looking good, you know. So it can give them some information about your homeschool that they might surreptitiously take notes about, you know, as they're thinking about it. I actually brought one course description with me, and I said, I have course descriptions for each class. Would you like this kind of information as well? Just to kind of float that idea, right? And they were very happy with it because many colleges now are not requiring course descriptions. Some are. I'd probably say 50% do not require course descriptions. However, the colleges that I've spoken to have unanimously said it would help their decisions about admission if they did have them. They're trying to get more people to apply. They would love for all applicants to pay full price for college. But at the same time, our job is to get them into the college that's right for them and to make sure that they get good scholarships. And that's why I think that the course descriptions will help. Well, okay, that's the end of our questions. Not too many questions today. I wanted to say thank you all for coming. I really appreciated you all being here. I hope this has been really helpful. If you need more information, the book College Admission and Scholarships has all the details on all the different issues that I brought up today. And I hope that's been helpful for you. Okay, guys, have a great day. Take care. Bye-bye.